It is my esteemed privilege to present to you the Secretary of Agriculture of the United States, the Honorable Henry A. Wallace.
Mr. Toastmaster, Reverend clergy, my very good friend, the Postmaster General James Farley, we have indeed listened to a singularly honest, straightforward, and challenging address this evening, given in the true Jeffersonian tradition. On this annual occasion, the program sponsored by the National Democratic Club is more than a tribute to Thomas Jefferson and a commemoration of the 196th anniversary of his birth. It is a recognition of Jefferson's love for his fellow man and the powerful influence his thinking still exerts on human affairs. Every loyal Democrat today has derived some inspiration from Jefferson. Because Jefferson lived, every loyal Democrat today has a stronger faith in democracy as a way of life and a greater zeal for making democracy work. This is especially true here in the state of New York. No Democrat can come to such a distinguished gathering as this without paying tribute to those who have done so much to make New York democracy virile. First and highest on the roll is a leader who for 30 years has given himself unsparingly to New York State and to the United States, who has fought unflinchingly for the interests of the common man. He is still fighting for the common people, for their right to live and work in peace and comfort, not only in the United States, but in the smallest and humblest nation throughout the world. He stands as a symbol of peace and security for all. That leader is the greatest progressive Democrat in this century, and probably of all time, President Franklin D. Roosevelt. Battling at his side, both in New York and in the United States, has been James A. Farley. Now Postmaster General and Chairman of the Democratic National Committee and of the State Democratic Committee, probably no one has been so active, no one who has been so active and so powerful in political life on a nationwide scale has played the game so cleanly as he. Always he has been found on the constructive side, endeavoring to harmonize conflicting forces, not merely for the sake of the Democratic Party, but for the welfare of the entire nation. We all love Jim. I want also to pay special tribute to the other Democratic leaders from this state who, by their progressive statesmanship, have won the respect of voters over the entire country. All these have been a tower of strength to the Democratic Party in this state and in the nation. To such men, the words Jeffersonian Democrat have real meaning. And yet I wonder if we Democrats realize how universal is the appeal of Jefferson. In late years, even the Republicans have tried to claim him. Both Jefferson and Lincoln, while they were ardent party men, now have a place in the eyes of the American people that is far above the clamor of party strife. It is very appropriate that in the national capital, not far from the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial, there is being erected another memorial bearing the name of Thomas Jefferson. And so tonight, we take our stand not only as Jeffersonian Democrats, but as Jeffersonian Americans. The life of Thomas Jefferson is a constant source of encouragement to those of us who believe that the Democratic Party can win nationally only if it is a progressive party, standing for unity in agriculture, sympathy between agriculture and labor, and a constructive attitude toward business. Jefferson continually re-examined the facts to discover what changes must be made in policies to meet new circumstances. He distrusted the habits of the past because he knew that blind attachment to the past, provoke people into violent deeds like those of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic dictatorship. Stand-patism to him was utterly abhorrent. In several important ways, our years are more like the years of Jefferson. As a principal author of the Declaration of Independence, then as Secretary of State under Washington, later as President, and still later as a kind of elder statesman, Jefferson lived through one of the most dynamic periods of modern times. During Jefferson's life, tremendous political and economic and social changes took place. Old institutions and old ways were swept into the discard by the rush of mighty events. New institutions had to be built, and new ways had to be adopted if civilization was to continue its onward march. Because Jefferson realized the vital necessity of keeping always a fresh viewpoint, he would, if he were alive today, be the last person in the world to expect his words of more than 100 years ago to be a literal guide for us. Nevertheless, the problems of his time were so similar to the problems of our times that his point of view and his philosophy are full of meaning for we who live today. For us today, the fate of democracy hangs in the balance. So did it hang in the balance in Jefferson's time. Jefferson was not content with lip service to democracy. He took his democracy straight, undiluted with vested privilege. He did everything he could to set as cornerstones of America 4 great equalities: equality of opportunity in voting, equality of opportunity in making a living, equality of opportunity in education, and equality of opportunity in worshiping one's God, following one's conscience, and speaking one's mind. In our years, too, equality of opportunity has been at issue for millions of our people. If there is any one thing above all others for which the New Deal stands, it is the effort to assure equality of opportunity to these millions. And if I make no mistake, equality of opportunity is all that most of these millions who are struggling desperately to get along have wanted or expected. What a travesty on democracy it is, just because a few are indolent, to make these millions the objects of ridicule and scorn. I know it is a fashion in certain circles to treat anyone employed on government work projects as if he were a social outcast. But who of us has the right to hurl the stone? Have not the farmers, weighed down with surpluses and low prices, turned to government for assistance in setting up machinery to cope with their difficulties? Have not the banks and financial institutions turned to the government for credit through the RFC? Have not hundreds of businessmen and business corporations fallen back on government contracts to keep them going in slack times? Have not thousands of other businessmen and business corporations gotten out of the red only with the help of the government's recovery measures? Then why pick on those who are struggling the hardest to feed their children and keep a roof over their heads? It's time we showed them decent consideration as fellow human beings. It's time we showed them Jeffersonian fair play. For us today, a vital task is the reestablishment of economic order after a period of breakdown and confusion. That was a vital task when Jefferson helped Washington to end the terrible confusion of 150 years ago. So also in our time, in 1933, Franklin D. Roosevelt led a magnificent effort by all our people to clear away the debris from the crash and build anew. That work still goes ahead. It has fallen to my lot to lend my services especially to agriculture. For more than 15 years, the 7 million farmers of the United States and the 24 million people dependent on them have been trying to gain the moral, the legal, and economic equivalent of what the corporate form of organization gives to industry. In the 20s, they tried through the McNary-Haugen Bill to get government power to meet the world situation which had been brought on by government action. The government had urged farmers to plow up 40 million additional acres of land to help win the war. The government had told them that a hog was worth a shell and that it was vital to produce more wheat. After the war, it was government which held to higher tariffs, making it impossible for countries overseas, unless we loaned them the money, to buy from us their customary pre-war quantities of cotton and wheat and lard. Continually through the 20s, farmers fought to get enacted into law the McNary-Haugen Bill and other methods of using government power to meet this underlying situation. After 4 years of struggle, they were victorious in Congress, only to lose out when a Republican president twice vetoed their plan. Many farm leaders remember with gratitude Al Smith's support to the McNary-Haugen Bill in September of 1928. It was Al Smith's Omaha speech which caused me to work actively in 1928 for the election of a Democratic president. Farm leaders are grateful also to the Democratic congressmen from New York City who have consistently voted for farm legislation. Al Smith's support and the support of the New York congressional delegation were an important help toward establishing unity between the agriculture of the South and of the West. That unity at last came to flower in terms of action in 1933, when the farmers for the first time got a sympathetic president along with a sympathetic Congress. The Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1933, based on the principle of fair exchange value for their products, was the result. But again, the farmers lost out when the Supreme Court in 1936 told them that agriculture was only a local matter. Once more, they renewed their struggle. They got the Soil Conservation and Domestic Allotment Act of 1936, the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1938, and now this week, they have won their fight. The Supreme Court of the United States, in upholding the constitutionality of the marketing quota provisions of the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1938, has placed the seal of final approval upon economic democracy the farmers have fought so long to build. For the first time since the World War, the farmers have in Washington a sympathetic Congress, a sympathetic president, and a sympathetic Supreme Court that has gone back to the Constitution itself as a basis for its decisions. That three-horse team is pulling the farmer's plow, and it is not turning back. I do not mean to say that agriculture's problems are all solved, or that farmers are on the road to a life of ease and plenty. Serious problems are still facing important farm groups. For example, dairy farmers who supply this great market for fluid milk in New York City have been deprived of the living price for milk and the orderly marketing plan, which for 5 months they enjoyed under the 7-state marketing agreement program placed in effect last September by the United States Department of Agriculture with the help of the farmers. This plan, I might say in passing, had the full backing of Governor Lehman, who at all times has cooperated splendidly with the Department of Agriculture in trying to find a solution for the New York farmers' problems. But 2 months ago, the dairy farmers of the New York area were plunged back into chaos because the marketing order was temporarily at least held invalid. This program came into being through the united efforts of the farmers. Their united efforts will still be needed, along with great patience, during this period of ruinous prices which they are being forced to undergo until the issue can be settled in the United States Supreme Court, until they can find out that the Agricultural Marketing Agreement Act of 1937 stands on a par with the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1938. The problems of agriculture are not insoluble as long as the machinery is available to farmers to enable them to cope with their problems. Advance indications are that participation in the AAA farm program this year will be the greatest it has ever been. Nearly 6 million farm families, 85% of all the farm families in the United States, will cooperate in 1939 in this program of balanced farming and soil conservation. In the corn and wheat region, the striking increase in interest is evidenced by the fact that from 15 to 20% more farmers are taking part this year than last. The cooperating farmers are members of the 3,000 county associations which along with the general farm organizations and cooperative marketing groups now are to agriculture what the corporations and labor unions are to city people. The farm program is continually evolving to meet changing needs of both farmers and consumers. A new experiment, which if successful may be of far-reaching value, is the food order stamp plan to feed the needy, which is being tried next month for the first time in Rochester. The businessmen of the wholesale and retail grocery trade have unanimously endorsed this plan and are taking the lead to make it work to the greatest advantage of all. Through this plan, we hope to help farmers dispose of more of their surpluses, give low-income groups in the cities better nourishment and better health, and bring business more volume. If successful and applied on a wider scale, this plan will be a three-way contribution to the general welfare. We want our low-priced food surplus so far as possible to be consumed at home rather than shipped abroad. In Jefferson's time, most food was consumed within 20 miles of where it was produced. Today, food moves over the seven seas. In Jefferson's time, farmers needed to think only in terms of adequate supplies for their own families. Today, they have to think in world terms. What American farmers really are aiming for is an ever-normal granary program on a national and an international scale, stabilizing market supplies and market prices, and thus helping in an important way to stabilize general business. The National Farm Program is the American farmer's answer to the thunderings of the dictators. This program is Jeffersonian democracy adapted to the needs of today. What the farmers have done and are doing is an example of what I mean when I say a vital task of our years is to build anew. Labor and business are also faced with a stern necessity of organizing themselves to meet the new problems of a new age. In the last 6 years, labor like agriculture has made great strides forward. Your own Senator Wagner has been largely responsible for this. Labor's right to organize for collective bargaining is recognized more clearly in federal statutes, in the decisions of the courts, and in the eyes of the general public than ever before. This period of organizing, to be sure, has not all been smooth. In the clash of interests, friction has been created, and friction always gives rise to heat. But the time of the most heated dispute seems to have gone by, and we can all hope that a period of better understanding between labor unions and employers, between labor unions and the rest of the public, and between contending elements within labor movement itself is coming at last. Sometimes the strong passions aroused in connection with labor disputes keep some people from realizing that fairer wages and better working conditions resulting from collective bargaining, as well as from the operation of the Fair Labor Standards Act, are really in the interests of the general welfare. Every worker, like every farmer, is a customer for the products of the farm and the factory. Fair play for both the factory workers and the farmers must be a cardinal principle of Jeffersonian democracy as we build our nation over. In this job of rebuilding, an essential role must fall to businessmen. This 20th century is a machine age, and a machine age is an age of business. American life as we know it centers largely around business, and without the constructive help of businessmen cooperating with the constructive leadership of agriculture, the constructive leadership of labor, and the constructive leadership of government, the general welfare cannot be adequately served. Business in the past has been ahead of agriculture and labor in getting highly organized, and yet I am not sure that business in the last few years has kept up with agriculture and labor in learning to gear itself to the general welfare. It would be a splendid thing if businessmen would take the initiative in setting up machinery that would help guide business toward increased production, employment, and distribution. Insofar as businessmen succeed in this effort, farmers and workers will share in the increased prosperity of a balanced, continuing abundance. We do not want an increased and unstable productivity based on the sands of overloaning at home and abroad, as was the case in the 20s. The next time we get an $80 billion income, we should make sure that it is more firmly based than the $80 billion income of 1929. We want our $80 billion national income based on the flow of capital which can soundly be paid off over a period of time through selling the goods produced from the invested capital at a profitable but not excessive price. The application of the principles of Jefferson does not need to interfere with the flow of private capital. Properly applied, Jeffersonian principles ought to encourage a balanced flow of private capital so as to bring the kind of business stability in which democracy thrives best. There is a happy middle course which will best proportion from time to time, as circumstances may make necessary, the relative volume of the respective flow of governmental and private investment. We can have a far greater flow of private investment than we've had during the past 9 years without any danger of entering on the excesses of the 20s. It is essential that we know what volume of private and governmental investment is needed to put our economy on an expanding and abundant basis. We ought to decide on the avenues where that investment is best used and most needed, and encourage capital to flow in the volume that is required to put our people back to work. And so our task, as we go forward today, is to find ways of harmonizing agriculture, labor, industry, and government so as to increase the national income and the well-being of all. We ought to lose no time in making sure of an $80 billion national income such as we had in 29, and then we should immediately drive ahead with united effort toward a $100 billion national income. If we all work together, that goal can and will be reached. I wish it were possible to focus on this national problem without giving the thought to what is happening overseas today. But today, as in Jefferson's time, a conquering dictator is shaking the world. Jefferson was president in a time of strife and bloodshed in foreign lands. He found that the United States could not stand fully aloof, no matter how rigid might be the enforcement of an embargo act. In 1815, in a letter written from his home at Monticello, he gave his mature judgment. Referring to the opinions he had held in 1804, he said, "I had then persuaded myself that a nation distant as we are from the contentions of Europe, avoiding all offense to other powers and not over hasty in resenting offense from them, doing justice to all, faithfully fulfilling the duties of neutrality, performing all the offices of amity, and administering to their interest by the benefits of our commerce, that such a nation, I say, might expect to live in peace and to consider itself merely as a member of the great family of mankind. That in such a case it might devote itself to whatever it could best produce, secure of a peaceable exchange of surplus for what could be more advantageously furnished to others, as takes place between one country and another. But experience has shown that continued peace depends not merely on our own justice and prudence, but on that of others also." That is the end of the quotation. If that was true in Jefferson's time, when 6 weeks to 2 months were required to cross the ocean, how much more true it is today, when airplanes go from continent to continent in a few hours, and people's voices are instantaneously carried by radio around the world. That is why, as we tackle our difficult internal problems today, we must earnestly hope that the great message of President Roosevelt, pleading for the peace of the world, will not go unheard. That is why the democracies, in pleading for the cause of peace, should make crystal clear their resolve to be fully prepared against every danger. For the democracies, the cause of peace and the cause of preparedness go hand in hand. as we prepare here in the United States, let us endeavor to put aside our controversies in the interest of national unity. Let us not engage in angry debates like the one over slavery in 1819, which Jefferson, with uncanny premonition, said was like a fire bell in the night. Let us practice the tolerance that Jefferson himself exemplified so well. Let us try to be as forgiving as Jefferson was toward his political enemies, who, really believing that the doctrine of equal rights would destroy peace, order, freedom, and property, called him an assassin and a liar. In spite of all the hammering he received, Jefferson retained his sweet and constructive spirit. The hope of our nation and the hope of the world lie in that kind of tolerance. The hope of our nation and the hope of the world lie in building a progressive democracy adapted to the problems of our time. A progressive democracy that gives a richer life to all the people, in country and city alike. America means to us what the promised land meant to the children of Israel. As we look abroad over the world, we know America is verily a land flowing with milk and honey. Yes, America, our chosen land, is the hope of the future. It has been built out of many races, many ideas, and it is now being forged into a mighty unity.
From the main ballroom of the Hotel Commodore in New York City, we have brought you the principal address at the annual Jefferson Dinner of the National Democratic Club, delivered by Secretary of Agriculture Henry A. Wallace.